this is an Eton educated fanatic, and he has little scant regard for public health. We know that he was resistant to the idea of a second lockdown in the winter. He said, let the bodies pile high. This is coming from Dominic Cummings, who is then his chief advisor. The man's a disgrace. He has a stone in his chest where his heart should be, and he's shown that throughout this pandemic.
Does the public have any idea when the pandemic restrictions will finally be lifted? Or do people fear that these limitations on civil liberties, including vaccine passports and travel restrictions, will be in place forever?
I think it will change, definitely. It's just given it time. As long as no more variants come in or another strain of something comes in, I think you can't control us forever that way. It's no good for the economy. It won't do any good for anyone, so you can't stay in it forever, definitely not.
Eventually, I think this is going to be around in some form or another, with some kind of restrictions for maybe 4 or 5 years. Who can see beyond that? I'm not a scientist. I really don't know.
I think we'll be living with it for a long time. There does seem to come a point where you have to jump one way and the other, I think. But certainly it seems like we are reaching a form of, almost by accident, a form of herd immunity. But I think certainly the people, I think people wish to still wear the mask and still keep their distance. So I think it'll almost be pushed by the public more than central government. I think that's certainly way it feels. Certainly where I live in Bristol, it's the compliance is still really, really strong. Even though you go into a shop, people say you don't have to wear a mask, but you know, people do.
I hope so. But part of me deep down thinks no. But can but hope.
Not forever, but for a long, long time. I reckon another 3 years at least before it's perhaps to what it was in 2019, 2020. I think we're just, like I said before, we've got to hold our breath and be patient, because it's going to take a long time to work its way out, I think.
I understand the argument, and certainly if you look at a lot of people in dependent sage, they will have a similar point of view. I think that we're not going to see hugely increasing rates of vaccination. Now we're getting to the point where GPs are returning vaccine to the vaccine programme, because actually the people they're offering it to at this stage are the ones who do not want to have it. So what we've now reached is probably we're getting close to the limits of the people who will voluntarily accept vaccination. The question is whether we're going to coerce them or persuade them. I would advocate persuasion. It seems as if our government are going down the lines of coercion, which will create further problems and compound the inequalities. In terms of the world, this is far from over. Okay, if we look at Indonesia, they've only vaccinated perhaps 5% of their population. The only country throughout this pandemic, well, one of the few countries, there are others, who managed it really well, are China, who had an initially very stringent lockdown in the areas affected, targeted response, graded response across their community, used technology, mobilized their resources to deal with it, and through public health measures prior to any vaccination were able to achieve zero COVID. I have total sympathy with the people from independent stage experts who essentially think we should achieve independent COVID. But we have to recognize that within our socio-political system and with a government and an economy that are totally unwilling to make the changes to achieve that, whilst we can criticise and say we shouldn't have started from here, we are where we are. And actually the only effective tool we've had is vaccination. Vaccination has worked for us. What we really need to do is vaccinate the rest of the people. Yes, there can be further variants. Actually, we've seen that vaccines are effective against all the variants that we've seen so far. So this is something to monitor, but not something to radically change our perspective, in my opinion. But the other countries, yes, we need urgently to allow them to deal with it. They haven't got social systems that have allowed them to achieve zero COVID. They're getting, massive waves, as we've seen in Indonesia, as we've seen in India.
Right.
And that is a system, that is the system of global inequality that is also inherent to our world today that we're dealing with, rather than a medical problem.
Well, I'm following the medical science. I'm not following Boris Johnson. It was Boris Johnson or his government that was telling me that I had to do these certain things in order to manage COVID. Then I would be asking serious and cynical questions. But I think we have a problem. We have a crisis of media information, and we have a crisis when it comes to the growing traction of conspiracy theory, because we now have some of these conspiracy theory cranks, and they are cranks, they're anti-public health cranks, who are now turning their guns on the NHS. There was a demonstration in London just last weekend Some of the speakers were comparing NHS doctors and nurses to Nazi doctors and nurses that were working in concentration camps in the Second World War. You could not believe it. This is where we are now. This is a debased culture. And the conversation around COVID has been absolutely horrific on the fringes, but it has a growing traction with otherwise intelligent people now believing that this is some sort of encroaching fascism. Wearing a mask is an unacceptable imposition, and social distancing is the start of some kind of lurid conspiracy in order to keep us under control in some kind of open prison with the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and you name it. So there have been a lot of casualties of COVID, those who died of the disease, those who suffered long COVID, but there's also been casualties of those who suffered a collapse in intelligence and in nationality.
There is increasing anger and frustration about the limits on international travel, with people losing confidence in their ability to understand what they're allowed to do. They fear that if they do book something, they'll end up high and dry abroad or facing quarantine at home. With the additional revelations of messages by Dominic Cummings about his former boss, the Prime Minister, which seemed to suggest Boris Johnson was not very worried about elderly COVID-19 deaths, many question how seriously the government is taking the impact of the disease on the elderly and infirm.
There is a risk that the government will lose the cooperation of the British public through inconsistency, confusion, and the fact that ministers themselves have set a bad example through their own behaviour. For Britain and for the world, the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, but it's quite possible that the British government is losing the faith and authority over the British public to handle this serious situation.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at the rights of women in Islam, and I don't need to repeat myself of why we're doing it, only because we're under attack, being labeled as a backward religion when it comes to giving women her rights, where in fact there is no system in the world that has given women more rights than Islam. The third right that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to women is the right to learn. Yes, you heard me right, the right to learn. So you're saying, well, is there places where a woman doesn't have the right to learn? Yes, back in the day, women weren't even supposed to read or write. And even today, if you look, do a bit of search on Google, you'll see a lot of places women are not even allowed to attend schools. And even in some civilized nations, women are not allowed to attend schools, or through some religious rituals or ideologies, you'll find that a lot of these ideologies do not allow women to learn for reasons I don't want to mention. What we see in Islam, it has given women her fundamental right to learn any kind of knowledge that will benefit her or humanity. Whether it is matters of concerning things of living, for example, she can study psychology, maths, for example, or physics or chemistry, or whatever subject she's into, she can learn it. And she could also learn Islamic studies. She could learn philosophy. She could learn Islamic principles or jurisprudence, or tafsir of the Quran, commentary of the Quran, and all these fields that a man could study, a woman could study. So she can study religious studies, and at the same time, she could really study. She can study. At the same time, she could study life studies, which we are required. So both are given to her, where compared to other religions, they forbid women from learning religious stuff. They can learn other things, for example, but they cannot learn physical stuff. So Islam says no. In the same way that a man can learn, so can woman. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, in chapter Ar-Rahman, in verse 3 and verse 4, he says, خلق الإنسان, created humankind. And an insan, humankind, it includes what? Both males and females. And then what does the ayah says? عَلَّمَهُ الْبَيَانِ, he taught him knowledge. He taught him how to speak. He taught him things, right? So that also includes what? Men and women. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in another verse, in verse 5 in chapter Al-Alaq, Allah says, عَلَّمَ الْإِنسَانَ مَا لَمْ يَعْلَمْ, he taught man or mankind, al-insan, mankind, what he did not know. And also again, Allah here says, when he says mankind, that includes both males and females. Again, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, he says, in chapter Az-Zumur in verse 9, he says, قُلْ هَلْ يَسْتَوِي الَّذِينَ يَعْلَمُونَ وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ, say, do those who know and those who do not are equal? Obviously not. Those who are logical, those who are knowledgeable, are much higher than those who are ignorant and not knowledgeable. So Allah, again in this ayah, includes both men and women. So women who are more knowledgeable, they're even higher than men who are not knowledgeable. And even higher than men who are knowledgeable if they are more knowledgeable than them. And so on and so forth. So Allah, and knowledge, when it comes to knowledge, he says both males and females have the right to learn and be learned. Let's take a break and we come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. So before, we said Islam gives women the right to learn, and this is her fundamental right to learn any knowledge that a man could learn, or a knowledge that is allowed, obviously not a forbidden knowledge. So women can learn just like a man, compared to other societies, other cultures, other religions, other faith, ideologies, and what have you. Even if we look at examples of from learned Islamic women. For example, we have a hadith that says the dowry of Hawa, the mother, or the Hawa, the wife of Adam alayhi salam, Eve as we call her. It's said in the narration that her dowry was for Adam to teach her. So knowledge was her dowry. So which means it's fundamentally a woman being given the right to learn. Khadija alayhi salam, the wife of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, which we mentioned in previous episode, she herself was a woman who were taught at the books of the previous religions like the Torah and the Injil, the Bible. She knew them. She was a smart woman. She was an educated woman. She was a woman, a businesswoman. So she was very educated before she even became a tradesperson and accumulated her wealth. So she knew both the knowledge of religions and she knew the knowledge of the material world. And she combined the two and gave us Khadija alayhi salam. Her daughter Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha, where the Prophet says, Alimatun ghayr mu'allama. She's a learned person without being taught. And she, you know, she was herself Fatima al-Zahra. And I don't want to say who Fatima al-Zahra is salamullah alayha, but her knowledge, she's infallible. Her knowledge precedes the knowledge of everybody beside her, obviously her father and her husband. So she's very knowledgeable herself, and that's just an example. Her daughter, so Khadija, her daughter is Fatima alayhi salam. The daughter of Fatima alayhi salam is Zainab, and we all know how eloquent and how smart and how knowledgeable Zainab alayhi salam. And we know this obviously through the sermons that she gave when she was being paraded through the streets of Kufa and in the castle of Yazid, may Allah curse him. And we see her eloquent and her knowledge flows through her tongue. And even when she was in Medina and when she was in Kufa, she was having her own classes. She used to teach women hadith and she used to teach women Quran. So she not only she was learning, but she was teaching. Also now it's even a necessity to have women learning, for example, medicine, because we have women and our women need to be cured. So we need to have female doctors, female nurses. We need to have female teachers. We need to have female engineers. And we need that woman force in our life, right? Because sometimes our life depends on that aspect of learning. So it becomes compulsory on women to even learn. So Islam says woman has that right to learn. Contrary to that of those who say women should not learn because if they learn, then they will be corrupted. If they learn, they might lead. If they learn, they might create havoc on earth. No, not such a thing. Islam says any man, be it a male or female, if they have knowledge and taqwa and piety, they will be good. If a person, male or female, they have knowledge but they have no piety, then obviously their knowledge could lead them to being corrupted or corruption. So we need to be aware that Islam has given women the right to learn. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Qad al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim narjuka ahsin khatmina. In the limelight.
America's giant intelligence failure in Afghanistan will frighten its friends and comfort its rivals, says Peter Osborne Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. Humiliation in Afghanistan Could Be a Turning Point in World History. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. It's just over three decades since the Soviet Union was driven out of Afghanistan in a moment of epic national humiliation. 32 years on, and recently the United States has suffered the identical fate. In each case, the same story, a global superpower defeated by a peasant army from one of the poorest countries in the world. This is a world historical moment. It raises two momentous questions. The first concerns Afghanistan itself. Will the nation subside into civil war as happened after the collapse of Soviet rule? The second concerns the United States. Will victory for the Taliban mark the end for the United States global power? There are reasons to suppose that the answer is yes. Collapse is possible, but there are reasons to hope not. First, Afghanistan has endured more than 40 years of conflict since the Soviet invasion of 1979. Most people yearn for a quiet life, and Afghans have more reason to be tired of war than most. Secondly, the Taliban that seized power in Kabul in mid-1990s and committed such terrible atrocities was primitive, sectarian, bigoted, shaped by poverty and suffering. By contrast, many Taliban leaders are more sophisticated, some with university degrees and far less sectarian. This helps explain why their consistent message since winning power recently has been to reach out to all sides. There are also deep concerns about women's rights, fully justified due to the Taliban's long history of misogyny. Here, too, the Taliban have been making welcome noises about girls' education. Many do not believe them, and we should all be skeptical. History can give us some insight. The Taliban have been ruling large swathes of rural Afghanistan for several years, so we know what the rule looks like. According to an impressive study, Life Under the Taliban Shadow Government, written by Ashley Jackson and financed by Denmark, the Taliban have sought to correct many of the flaws and shortcomings that undermined the rule in 1990s. The ban on women and girls attending school has been removed, though most Taliban officials insist no ban existed in the first place, and the Taliban have publicly stated that all women should have access to education. In practice, the report frankly admits this research could not identify a single girl's secondary school open in an area of heavily Taliban influence or control. However, Jackson points out that this is a general problem in rural Afghanistan and not restricted to Taliban areas. There are many Taliban factions, and the leadership will find it hard to control them all. A return to the bloodshed of 1990s is possible, but we hope and believe that the signs are reasonably good. Now, we turn to the future of the United States Empire. Ever since 1945, some would argue before, the United States has been the dominant global power. The recent humiliation of the U.S. places a giant question mark over that status and may come to be seen as a turning point in world history. There are many reasons for thinking this. The failure of the U.S. to foresee how quickly the Taliban would enter Kabul demonstrates yet again the Americans' congenital inability to understand the country it has occupied for 20 years. This giant intelligence failure will frighten its friends and comfort its rivals. But U.S. President Joe Biden knows the country he leads has lost the taste for foreign entanglement and war. He may be mocked in foreign capitals and inside the State Department. But what a message these events send to U.S. allies. Former U.S. President Donald Trump unkindly told Saudi King Salman he wouldn't last 2 weeks without U.S. support. The events of the last week have shown that the U.S. will cheerfully ditch its allies. The House of Saud will not be the only regime looking to forge a new set of relationships as the United States backs away. Europe, too, will need to rethink its security architecture. Henry Kissinger once remarked that it may be dangerous to be America's enemy, but to be America's friend is fatal. That remark has never seemed as relevant as today.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson, beware of sensuality. Undoubtedly, internal enemies are more dangerous than external foes. Therefore, obstinate desires, which affect man inwardly, are considered as the most dangerous enemy for man. Sensuality blinds the eye and deafens the ear. It extinguishes the light of wisdom, distorts the face of truth, and finally leads a man to the precipice of corruption. This is probably why Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, who's the sixth infallible Imam, has said, beware of sensual desires in the same way as you watch out of your obstinate enemies, because man has no enemies greater than following sensual desires and the outcomes of his tongue. So, brothers and sisters, it is time for us to introspect. It is time for us to reflect. It is time for us to use our intellect and our wisdom and evaluate whether we are stuck in fulfilling our sensual desires or do we have a higher purpose to our lives. Well, guess what? If we are honest to ourselves, most of the times, most of us are going to reach a conclusion that most of us are, or let me talk about myself, right? We are stuck in this quagmire of fulfilling our sensual desires. And Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam has already warned us to watch out for these internal sensual desires in the same way as you watch out from your staunch enemies. So let's take our sensual desires to be our staunch enemies.
Ya Abba Abdullah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing sensuality and how it can work against us, against our development, against our progress, against everything that we are supposed to accomplish in this lifetime. The question we need to ask ourselves is, are we stuck with our sensual desires or not? Well, in this process, Islam has much to offer. In Islam's view, prevention is the best cure. Islam offers a system of human-to-human relations and social life that is devoid of sexualization. Prevention of sexual objectification in society, according to Islam, includes the forbidding of any lustful, sensual gaze among men and women, men and men, and women and women. Other measures include dress code, which is known as hijab in case of women. Men and women are also advised to avoid casual relationships and keep all social intimacy among close relatives. Sexual relations are strictly limited to marriage. These commandments together offer a holistic system, and this is very important, brothers and sisters. We're discussing this while we have a bird's eye view. And once you listen to this sentence, you will understand what I'm trying to say. These commandments in Islam together offer a holistic system that ensures the health of society so that men and women can both perform their functions and have the opportunity to reach their potential. This full potential is what we are after. So hope, inshallah, we will be beware of our sensuality. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. But anyone stay here won't be left tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough, even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money. And that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The US has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital Kabul faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
The shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries should also end all new fossil fuel exploration and production and shift fossil fuel subsidies into renewable energy. The alarm bells are deafening and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. He also added that the report makes clear that there is no time for delay and no room for excuses. The IPCC report came just 3 months before a major UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where nations will be under pressure to pledge vigorous climate action and significant financing. The UN climate report draws on more than 14,000 scientific studies and offers the most comprehensive and detailed portrait yet of how climate change is altering the natural world and what could still lie ahead.
This is like a big rock rolling downhill. You can't just say, oh my goodness, there's a big rock and stop it. It is a process that starts and keeps going, and it is not possible to stop it. We can deflect it, and we're not even doing a good job of that, but there are things we could do.
Almost every nation on Earth signed up to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. This pact aims to keep the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius this century and to pursue efforts to keep it under 1.5 degrees Celsius. This new report says that under all the emission scenarios considered by the scientists, both targets will be broken this century unless huge cuts in carbon take place. The authors believe that 1.5 degrees Celsius will be reached by 2040 in all scenarios. If emissions aren't slashed in the next few years, this will happen even earlier. Scientists further warn that warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average could trigger runaway climate change.
One of the things that could happen that is in the fat chance list, but it could, is that all the big corporations could say, we are on a war footing now against climate change. Everyone needs to cut their consumption of everything, and we are going to cut our production because we need to do that or we will not have a planet to live on.
With catastrophic impacts, such as heat so intense that crops fail or people die just from being outdoors. According to the Carbon Majors report, only 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1988.
That we should tell the companies, you can't do this. Not only should we prosecute, we should chop them off at the ankles, tell them they can't keep using resources and they can't keep going on with what they're doing. We will not allow them to keep producing and using resources and killing the planet.
It is expected that water problems like droughts, with its accompanying wildfires and flooding, are likely to become much worse around the world as climate breakdown takes hold. The effects will be felt across the globe, from the US, where drought is an increasing problem in the West and South, to India, where the monsoon may become more variable. Sub-Saharan Africa is also likely to experience increased drought in many areas, while flooding and drought will hit China and Europe.
Lebanon seems to be on the brink of an abyss as it grapples with a prolonged double crisis. Lebanon has been plagued by a political vacuum as politicians fail to agree on a government, while a devastating economic meltdown has become an existential threat. The situation has been widely described as the worst in Lebanon's history, with some warning that time is running out fast for those who wish to save the country. Lebanon has been without a government for a year now. The last government resigned in August 2020, days after a massive chemical blast destroyed much of the port of Beirut. The financial crisis has seen the Lebanese pound sink by more than 90% and pushed more than half of the population into poverty. The Lebanese Central Bank recently scrapped a fuel subsidy due to lack of funds. Lebanon is right now suffering from a painful fuel shortage that has caused long lines at petrol stations and worsened blackouts. Last week, over 24 people were killed when a fuel tanker exploded as people scrambled to fill gasoline in plastic containers. There have been warnings that the fuel crisis may soon force hospitals, bakeries, and other essential facilities to shut down. The grave situation has become a serious threat to the nation. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has begun acting in a bid to resolve the crisis. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has warned against any effort to block the transfer of Iranian fuel to Lebanon. Nasrallah has warned Israel and the U.S. to stay away from ships carrying the much-needed fuel for Lebanon. The Hezbollah chief says the tankers coming to Lebanon from Iran are Lebanese territory. The resistance movement has been a key player in Lebanese politics for many years and has gained popularity for its stance against Israel. The movement is very much despised by the West, especially the U.S., which is the closest ally of Israel. Western countries have imposed sanctions on Lebanon in a bid to limit Hezbollah's influence. The sanctions have played a major role in triggering the current financial meltdown. The resistance movement's ongoing effort to ease economic hardship in Lebanon will probably improve the situation to some extent. But observers believe any effective solution for the crisis needs cooperation by all Lebanese political parties. This week, Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati expressed optimism that a government could soon be formed. But on Thursday, Aoun said certain parties are blocking the formation of a new cabinet to push the country into chaos. Lebanon seems to need a competent government more than anything else at this point. Any further delay in forming a new government could have devastating consequences.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaykum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the Supreme Leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Welcome back, dear listeners of Islamic Laws from IRIB English Radio. Again, I would like to express my condolences on the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Sheikh Javid, in the previous program, the last question that I asked you was about the viewpoint of Ayatollah Khamenei about some of the ways of mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam which caused a serious harm on the body.
Yes.
Like tatbir and lashing oneself with chains and with blades and so on and so forth. I would like to ask you to give us a summary of your answer, and inshallah I will ask a related question.
Well, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to give Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion in brief about the practice of tatbir, or what is known in Farsi as qamazani, but the Arabic, the Arabs use the word